we're not going to go to Isaiah today. So I figured we have one more week in Isaiah, and I did not want to do that with so many folks out. So today, what I thought I'd do, I'm going to do a one-off message. It's something that I was reading a couple weeks ago that just really, I know I've read it before many times, but for some reason, the frame of mind I was in when I read this one, it was phenomenal. So let's go to Psalm 73. Psalm 73. And something I was thinking about, you guys know how I'm going to start Revelation first hour after we get done with Isaiah. You know, I was thinking about kicking it back to the first of the year. Tell me what you guys think. You don't necessarily have to do it now. Just think about it. What I was thinking about doing was delaying Revelation till the beginning of February and doing a little mini series on the intertestamental period and how the history of the intertestamental period and all the things that happened with that, how that prepared the way for the New Testament and how it impacted the New Testament, the culture, the political landscape, the ideology, the theology, so that we could have a better understanding of the gospel messages or of the gospels themselves. And to, because there, that's a tremendous period of time, and I don't think I've ever actually taught on it. And I don't think a lot of people actually have studied it out. Maybe you have, and I'm just the anomaly here. But I think something like that could be really interesting. Any thoughts on that?
So basically what you're saying is, because I assume your Revelation study is going to take like 5 years. So you're basically saying, would you like to talk about intertestamental stuff now or 5 years from now?
It won't be 5 years. I don't think Revelation is going to take that long, but those are my famous last words probably. I think I could be done. I think I could be done with Revelation by the end of 2025. Possibly. Or maybe I'll be done with the first few chapters by 2025. We'll see. But does that sound interesting to folks? Yeah, thumbs up. Okay. All right. No, nobody's going to do a Commodus and thumb up, thumb down. Okay. All right. Psalm 73. Let's do this. This is a Psalm of Asaph, and Asaph was a guy around during the time of David. So we don't know. There's a lot of Psalms of Asaph. We don't know, pretty confident actually, that Asaph didn't write all these Psalms, because some of these Psalms look like they're after the destruction of Jerusalem in the post-exilic period. What we're probably looking at are people from the line of Asaph who wrote these Psalms. Okay? So it's not something that is a specific person. You know, kind of like the sons of Korah wrote some, probably looking at this guy as one of the line. So we don't know really who essentially wrote this, except that they were of the line of Asaph. Now, this psalm has two essential parts. And I think I might actually be preaching this psalm at our family camp. I still haven't figured out the theme for family camp. Just when I think I have it all figured out, something else comes to mind. And I'm thinking about doing an entire family camp on the Psalms. I think that would be a lot of really encouraging and a lot of fun. And talking about, you know, power and praise through the Psalms and focusing on a lot of those things. And this is one of the ones that I'd like to do. So this would be a dry run and it would look a lot different in that context. But this Psalm, if you break it down, Psalm 73, it's all about perspective. It's all about perspective. And I think it's really applicable because I think why this hit me so hard is that this encapsulates what we're trying to do with the podcast. Start to finish. This encapsulates what we're trying to do. Because in the first half of the Psalms, up until verse 15, 1 through 15, it's all about looking at things from the world's perspective as they appear with your fleshly eyes. And then the writer gets a shift of perspective in Psalm 6 or in verse 16 and starts now to look at it through the lens of God, through the lens of the eternal. And what do you think happens to his perspective before and after? Completely changes. Utterly changes. And what this boils down to in the first episode that we've recorded twice and we'll be recording for a third time on Tuesday or sometime this week, that's one of the main thrusts that we have in that episode. is why do people interpret information the way they do? Two people look at the same set of data and they walk away with completely and utterly different conclusions. It boils down to their perspective of how they're looking at things and why they want something to be true. And unless we address those biases, we're never going to come to truth. Okay, so that's one of the main thrusts that we have. So we're really trying to focus on that. So let's go ahead and read verses 1 through 15. Surely God is good to Israel, to those who are pure in heart. But as for me, my feet came close to stumbling. My steps had almost slipped. For I was envious of the arrogant, as I saw the prosperity of the wicked. For there are no pains in their death, and their body is fat. They are not in trouble as other men, nor are they plagued like mankind. Therefore, pride is their necklace. The garment of violence covers them. Their eye bulges from fatness. The imaginations of their heart run riot. They mock and wickedly speak of oppression. They speak from on high. They have set their mouth against the heavens, and their tongue parades through the earth. Therefore, his people return to this place, and waters of abundance are drunk by them. They say, how does God know? And is there knowledge with the Most High? Behold, these are the wicked, and always at ease they have increased in wealth. Now look at that's his view. That's what he sees. Here's his interpretation for himself. Verse 13, surely in vain I have kept my heart pure and washed my hands in innocence, for I have been stricken all day long and chastened every morning. If I have said I will speak thus, behold, I would have betrayed the children of your generation. So he states, this is what I see. What I see is this. The wicked have it good. They really do. They're rich. They control everything. They have a life of peace. They die in peace. And they just have this whole concept that I can do anything I want. Tell me that's not what we see. That's a correct assessment, isn't it? If we're looking by the world standards. I mean, think about it this way. If God gave the wicked what they really deserved in this life, if he gave the rich what they want in this life, nobody would have the desire to be that. There would be no decision to make. If everybody who disobeyed God received in this life judgment, wouldn't everybody make the right choice? If the righteous, now think about this for a second. If the righteous were physically blessed, if the righteous had only good physical consequences, there really wouldn't be a choice to make, would there? And let's ask the question, if that was the way that it was, I mean, people think, well, isn't that what we want? We want people to make that decision to go to heaven. No, well, yes, but not like that. Not like that. Because let's ask the question, let's dig a little bit deeper, because most people who ask these questions, who get into these types of conversations, only go one layer deep. They don't think about the consequences of what they're asking God to do. So let's think about this for a second. If we had only physical blessings in this life, and immediately any wickedness or judgment received like a shock. I mean, every one of us has a shock collar around our neck. God holds the remote control. And anytime we do anything bad, zzz, brings us to our knees. And anytime we do something good, little human gets a treat. And everything goes well. They get rich. They've got health. They've got wealth. They've got power. Ask this question. The choice to be righteous, would it be based on faith and love? Or would it be based on greed and a desire to not have negative consequences? And then let's ask the next question. Does that type of system produce the kind of people that are truly righteous, holy, and good in love? No. Not at all. Not at all. It doesn't produce that at all. So what is God? And plus, it really violates free will, doesn't it? You can't have free will without facing, and this is something that a lot of people don't grab hold of. It's taken me a while to grab hold of it too, so it's not necessarily intuitive and it's not necessarily easy to understand. You can't truly have free will until you have the ability to face the full consequences of your actions. And other people face the full consequences of your actions. If God is always intervening, we will never become a responsible person. Think about what happens with the nanny state that we have, that hopefully is about to get reined in. If you have the constant social safety net, are people ever going to become truly responsible? We're seeing it in real time, aren't we? If there's always, and we see this with kids as they become adults, if we're constantly bailing our kids out, if mommy and daddy are always going to be there to bail their kids out, they're never going to become responsible. Ever. There needs to be some responsibility there. And the only way they're really going to have that is to face the full consequences of their actions. And our whole goal as parents is to raise up kids, hopefully, because you can't guarantee this, that'll be responsible. Because I'll tell you what, you can do the best job, and then sometimes they just decide, you know what? Nah. Nah. I'm going to try it this way. That's free will, isn't it? That's why that whole concept of teach a child the way they should go, and when they're old, they will not depart from it. People get that all messed up because they negate free will and the fullness of free will from that discussion. But that's not the point of this conversation, but that's just a side note. So that's the backdrop here. God allows people full free will. And since the God of this world is in control of things, here's what happens. He rewards people who do this. And people who do this, they have a choice where they can pursue the physical pleasure, they can pursue power, they can pursue wealth. And if they can get those things, their life's pretty cushy. Now, people have tried to make the claim that riches don't satisfy, and they don't to a certain extent. They don't really satisfy because if you think about it, all of these people that are rich, what do they want more of? Money, power. if it satisfied, they'd be satisfied with enough. But what's enough? When I was in Ohio, I had this client. He was like 80-something years old. He was a retired dentist. And he had millions of dollars. And he's in his 80s. Like I said, $3-4 million. And he was consumed by it. And he was my client. And he wanted a 10% income stream off, let's just say, $3 million. Everything's paid off. Do you know what you have to do to get a 10% income stream? For those of you who are familiar with the markets, the amount of risk you have to take with that kind of money? You can do it, but the types of vehicles you have to go with, I guarantee you, you're going to lose, or your principal value is going to fluctuate like crazy, and you're going to have potential to lose quite a bit of it. And so I looked at him. I said, what do you need $300,000 a year for? What do you need that for? I'm just afraid I'm going to run out of money. Like, I mean, no offense. What do you think your life expectancy is? Well, he says, I'm not in great health. I mean, I had to have frank conversations with clients. You know, he's like, I'm not in great health. I probably see myself living another 3 to 5 years. I said, how do you think you're going to spend $3 million? Well, what about long-term care? I said, long-term care is not going to cost that much. Nowhere near that much. In other words, he was obsessed with his money. He always wanted more. And he wanted his money to grow and to grow and to grow. And it's trying to advise him, no, this is not the right approach. But eventually, he does what he wants to do, right? I'm there to help him achieve his goals. But, you know, you document the tar out of that so that when stuff eventually falls, they don't come back and bite you. That's what Asaph is seeing, or the writer of Psalm 73 is seeing. Let's look at that a little bit more. He says, for I was envious and arrogant as I saw the prosperity of the wicked. That's verse 3. No pains in their death. Their body is fat. They're not in trouble like other men, nor are they plagued like mankind. I said, you know, a lot of people, they say that money doesn't satisfy, and that's true to a certain extent. But my other point was, it sure does make life easier. If you had to go through life not having satisfaction, would you rather go through it rich or poor? Rich any day of the week, man. Because if you're rich, you got a lot of distractions. You can do away with a lot of the pain, and you can have a superficial level of happiness. Because when that one thing that you have that you're enamored with loses its attraction, you could just go out and get the next one. And when that one loses, you could just go out and get the next one. You know, when your 200-foot yacht becomes too small, you can go get a 300-foot yacht. When the newest Gulfstream comes out, you can trade in your 3-year-old Gulfstream for the new one. Score. Now, what kind of impact did this have on Asaph? Well, look at verse 2. But as for me, my feet came close to stumbling, and my steps had almost slipped. He's looking at this and he said, even Asaph, this inspired writer, is saying, I had trouble dealing with this. What is Asaph having a trouble dealing with? He's having trouble dealing with what so many people have trouble with. How can God be who he is? How can God be God and this be the state of the world? Where these guys have all of this prosperity, and how do they have the ability to be this while God is who he is? They see a contradiction there. Chad?
Aren't those individuals that are always grasping for more, aren't they kind of groping for God the most? If God has set eternity in man's heart, they don't really know what they're groping for. They're just trying to fill that void with everything they can get their hands on, hoping it was satisfying.
Yep, they absolutely are. And some things are a little bit more satisfying than others, right? I mean, I like cars. If I had the ability to buy any car that I wanted, as many cars as I wanted, I'd be like Jay Leno and have like probably 50 of them in my garage. And I'd always be on the lookout for the next one. And that would provide me a surface level of happiness versus not having any money, getting up every day and working a job that I hate, can't pay my bills. there's a certain level of satisfaction there. And I think we need to be on, I mean, and we are, we're honest about that. I mean, there's a certain level of satisfaction there. Ultimately, it doesn't satisfy. And they have to keep, but they have the ability to keep pouring things down that hole where someone who's poorer does not. Diane?
We also have to be aware of the people that Satan is filling that hole. Satan promised Jesus all the kingdoms of the world if he would just bow down and worship him. And some people he's made that deal with.
Yep.
And they're very satisfied with their wealth.
Very.
So there's two different sides of that coin.
There is. There is. And they still want more. But they wouldn't give it up for anything, would they? I mean, look at the chief priests. The Romans will come and take away our place. They loved, as it states in John chapter 12, they loved the glory of men rather than the glory of God. For them, the glory of man was satisfying. Think about the people who are celebrities, who are powerful. They have that void being filled by the God of this world. And for them, that's good. They've got everything that they want. But at the end, it's not going to satisfy completely. Right? And this is what Asaph sees. He knows who God is. He has a relationship with God. But he's looking at this and he's seeing, my life doesn't match this. My life is hard. Being righteous or trying to be righteous is difficult. You know this. I know this. Wouldn't life be easier if we could just kill our conscience? Wouldn't life be easier if we didn't renew the mind? Wouldn't life be easier if we just didn't have to do battle with ourselves all the time? It'd be a lot easier. Asaph sees this. And he's like, this is why I love the scriptures, because a lot of times these writers are very vulnerable. And they're saying, I almost fell, or I did fall. God wants us to understand that if you feel or think that, you're not the only one. And there is a remedy. Jeremiah?
I was just thinking that I completely understand everything you're saying and agree with it. Though when it comes to people accepting or engaging in sin rather than trying to overcome temptation, there is still a natural consequence for sin.
Sure.
Right? I mean, a person who, I just want to steal something so I don't have to pay for it.
Yep.
You know, that'd be a lot easier than actually working for something and paying for it and buying it with hard-earned money, right?
Sure.
Okay, well, yeah, that might be easier, but there's still going to be a consequence for that here on this in this world. So it's.
But I don't think he's talking about those people.
Right. I'm just throwing that out there.
Yeah. He's not talking about those people. He's not talking about evildoers necessarily, like, you know, the people who go out and steal or rob or, you know, do all that. He's talking about the rich. And that's really the main thing that I'm trying to get across is that life's a lot easier for those folks. It just is. And remember what Jesus said? What did he say about rich men? It's hard to get in the kingdom of heaven. Very, very hard. There's really two groups of people that I'm thinking of off the top of my head. And I know there's others. They're, you know, fools. They're hard to deal with. Those who have their consciences seared. But these people are part of that group. But there's two groups of people that typically have a really, really hard time. The rich and the wise in their own minds. Those two groups of people really struggle. And we still see that to this day. It's like, I find that there's a correlation. The more letters you have after your name, the harder it is for you to understand the simplicity and brilliance of the wisdom of God and the truthfulness that it contains. And the same thing with being wealthy. Right? So Asaph, he talks about in verse six, he talks about these folks. He says, pride's their necklace, garment of violence covers them. Their eye bulges from fatness, imaginations of their heart run riot. See, a lot of times people who are poor, they have imaginations of their heart, but they can't do anything to satisfy those. Imagine if you could have anything you wanted, physically. Anything. Think about how your mind would race. Ooh, I want this. Ooh, I want that. I want this. I want that. And then you could go out and get it. Now look at verse 8. They mock and wickedly speak of oppression. They speak from on high. They think they're gods. Isn't that what we see with the ruling class? The people who are in control of the governments of the world, the extremely wealthy? They feel like they can control everything. And they do to a great extent. Verse 9, they've set their mouth against the heavens and their tongue parades through the earth. Therefore, his people, he's talking about the people of these wicked people, their people, or his people return to this place. The waters of abundance are drunk by them. In other words, the disciples of these wealthy people, the ones who follow them, these wealthy people are influencers and they have followers. They drink their waters. They drink the garbage. They ingest the garbage that they're putting out. How many people these days have become wealthy for no reason? How many people make millions of dollars a year by having followers? I'm not saying that's what he's talking about. I'm saying the application is there. And here's what they say. Let's ask, does this question get asked today? Verse 11. How does God know? Is there knowledge with the Most High? God says something in his word, and they're like, how does God know? That's not accurate. Does he really know anything? Does the Bible really speak truth? Are those philosophies actually valid and accurate? Do they work? No, they don't. That's what they say. And for them, they don't. They're being accurate. For them, they don't. Because if they were to implement them, it would destroy everything that they are. So no, that doesn't work for me at all. And then verse 12, this is the final point that he makes before he interprets for himself. Behold, these are the wicked, always at ease, increased in wealth. Asaph's out there busting his rear end. Every single day, working hard, and not getting anywhere. And here's his conclusion for himself. Verse 13, surely, in vain I've kept my heart pure and washed my hands in innocence, for I have been stricken all day long and chastened every morning. How many people actually think that? I think it's more than we think, and perhaps even we've had those conclusions once in a while. Maybe not in vain, but man, this is hard. If I would have had a different set of priorities, my life would have turned out very differently. Absolutely. I personally know that. Now, I think of how my life would go, but who knows if I would have actually made those decisions. That's the folly of that type of thinking. I think, okay, knowing what I know now, if I would have done this back then, I'd be, you know, wherever, having all this stuff or all this, whatever the case is. But what you don't know is, would you have made the decisions necessary to get there? It's foolishness to think like that. Because you don't really know. Hindsight's always 20/20. Man, if I would have known certain stocks were going to do certain things and the market was going to do certain things, man, I'd be immensely wealthy right now. But the thing is, at that time, you didn't know they were going to do those things. So what changed Asaph's mind? Let's look at that. Look at verse 15. If I have said, I will speak thus, behold, I would have betrayed the children of your generation. In other words, if Asaph said, if I'm going to go ahead and speak this way and do these things, I would have betrayed my brethren. And this is what sometimes people don't recognize. Their actions have an impact on other people. We can either give people life or we can give people death, depending upon our actions. We can go ahead and offer those two things to people. And Asaph came to that recollection. He said, if I'd have spoken this way and would have changed my views, and this was the kind of person I am, I would have betrayed my brethren. And we all know how that happens. We've all been recipients of it. So, what changed his mind? Verse 16. When I pondered to understand this, it was troublesome in my sight. You know, it's like, man, I'm just thinking about this stuff. I'm having a really, really hard time reconciling what I see in the world versus who God is. I'm really having a hard time reconciling the morality of God. How can he allow this? Verse 17, everything changes right here. Until I came into the sanctuary of God, then I perceived their end. What changed his mind? What changed his mind is where he set his face. He came into the sanctuary. He focused on God. He focused on his glory. He focused on what he knew about God. And then everything became clear. You know what he did? He switched out the lens by which he interpreted the world. That's exactly what he did. He switched out the lens by which he interpreted the world. He was looking at the world through the lens of the world. He was looking at the world through the lens of the physical, and he saw the prosperity of the wicked. And if he wasn't considering anything else, just their lives, he said, that's the way it should be. That's the way it should be. That seems to be the right path because their life is easy. But as soon as he swapped out the lens of the physical for the lens of the eternal and looked at it through the eyes and character of God, everything became clear. And he said, I perceived their end. That's the problem with most folks. They don't look at the end. They look at what is. It is very easy to be a scoffer, a mocker, agnostic, atheist when you're young and everything's going well. It's exceptionally easy because you don't need anything. When your end is firmly in your face, that's when it's difficult. You know the saying, there's no atheists in foxholes. Chad, you're a lifetime military man. Is that accurate? It's very accurate. And you've been in situations where that's the case, right? Yeah. No atheists in foxholes. If that's the case, now I'm sure there's always exceptions to those axioms. I'm sure some people, you've seen it, some people face slipping into the next world, and they still hold on to their belief system. Absolutely, they do. And there's some substances out there that are going around, you know, like the microdosing of psilocybin, DMT, all of these different psychedelics that are allowing people to have experiences that make them comfortable with death outside of any religious Christian influence. I watched a documentary. It was on Netflix. It was about mushrooms. Paul Stamets, is that the guy's name? It was about him. And then at the end of the document, it talked about the health benefits of mushrooms, like lion's mane, cordyceps, reishi, all these things that have legitimate health value. And then at the end, they focused on two terminally ill people who, and they interviewed them before and after, terrified of death. Terrified of death. They were getting ready to die very quickly. Terminal cancer. They have a psychedelic experience. It's not even the microdosing. It was the full-on thing. They go on a trip. Psychedelic trip. They interviewed him afterwards. And both of them are like, I'm not afraid of death anymore. One person, I think, even said, I can't wait to die. Oxford University, I know I've said this before, did a survey of people who have had psychedelic experiences. And I forget the exact percentage, but it was in the low 90s. None of these people knew each other. They all state that they saw the same beings on their trip. You tell me what that is. They all saw the same beings, creatures, had interactions with the same. They looked the same. They talked the same. They acted the same. And they all had interactions with these creatures. And we're talking about hundreds, maybe thousands of people. What those psychedelics do, in my opinion, is they break down the barrier between the physical and the spiritual. And what's it sound like? If we know the scriptures to be true, what's it sound like? Who would be the main person interested in having people not be afraid of death without Christ? And that's why they're really pushing these terminally ill patients. There are some groups out there pushing for terminally ill patients to go through this. I'm just saying this is a very demonic thing to me. Very demonic thing. So he says, like I said in verse 17, until I came into the sanctuary of God, then I perceived their end. Now, look at it, the rest of his application here. Surely you've set them in slippery places. You cast them down to destruction. How they are destroyed in a moment. They are utterly swept away by sudden terrors. Like a dream when one awakes, O Lord, when aroused, you will despise their form. Now he understands. He understands that in the end, they're all going to be swept away if they hold on to that. They're all going to be swept away. They're all going to have their form despised by God. In other words, they're going to appear before God and he is going to judge them for who they are and what they've done. Who wants that? But again, if you're not thinking of those things, that doesn't matter, does it? My point is, our choice in this life is to determine what lens we're going to look at the world through. That's our choice. What are we going to look at the world through? That's our ultimate free will choice. What framework am I going to interpret the world through? And everybody has the same ability to do so. Everybody. And Asaph shows us it's a choice. He shows us it's a choice as to what lens you're going to use. And so in verse 21, he backs up a little bit and talks about where he was. When my heart was embittered and I was pierced within, then I was senseless and ignorant. I was like a beast before you. So Asaph's going back and looking at the previous way that he thought. And he said, I'm senseless and ignorant. Now, ignorant has become a pejorative in our language, in our time. But ignorant, properly understood, simply just means lacking information, a know-nothing. I am ignorant of a lot of things in this life. You know, I am ignorant of the Swahili language. Not something I've ever desired to study. Now, if I was ever going to go to places where Swahili was spoken, maybe I'd be more interested. Very ignorant. Those who look at things through the world-only lens, the way Asaph did, they don't really know anything. The most important things, they're not paying attention to. They're not valuing at all. As a matter of fact, he goes so far as to say, I was like a beast before you. I was like an unreasoning animal before you. Now, I want you to think about that for a second. Asaph was inspired to write that. That's how God views people like that. But it also shows his love, that he's willing to be patient with those unreasoning animals, because some of them are going to change their mind and be noble-minded and come to him. I was an unreasoning beast before the Lord, but he had mercy on me. He waited, you know, sometimes we're the prodigal and we're knee-deep in mud, spiritually speaking, with the pigs, starving, longing to fill our stomachs with the food of the pigs. And then we have a moment of clarity. I can go back to my father's house and say, I'm an unworthy slave. Just make me a slave, because that's better than this. And you're kind and you're generous and you're forgiving. I think a lot of people have that moment of reckoning, and then they decide to stay with the pigs. But God loves us so much, he's giving everybody that opportunity to make that decision. Now look at verse 23. So we're getting ready to wrap up here. He said, "Nevertheless, I am continually with you. You have taken hold of my right hand. With your counsel, you will guide me and afterwards receive me to glory." Whew. That's beautiful, man. Even though Asaph was doubting, God had patience with him. I'd like to encourage us to do the same. Let's not give up on people. Let's still pray for them. Still try to help if we can. Because maybe we can be the ones through whom God works that way. Now, pay attention to Asaph's conclusion. He goes from, you know, in vain I've kept my hands pure, or my heart pure, and washed my hands in innocence. I've been stricken all day. He goes from that to this. Verse 25. Whom have I in heaven but you? And besides you, I desire nothing on earth. Do you want that? Do you want that to be your mindset? Do you want that to be your attitude? Because it can be. It can be. We can have that mindset, that heart, that desire. We can have that. It just depends on the lens that we choose to look at things through. That's one of the foundational points here. You know, my vision's horrible. I have to wear contacts or glasses, and sometimes both. Otherwise, I can't see the world. I can't accurately figure out what the world is. If I took my contacts out, I wouldn't be able to see any of you. Functionally blind. Put my contacts in and everything becomes clear. I can see the world accurately. It's the same way for us. When we have the right lens and it's combined with the right heart, we can have no one in heaven but Him and desire nothing on earth but Him. Verse 26, my flesh and my heart may fail, but God is the strength of my heart and my portion forever. For behold, those who are far from you will perish. You have destroyed all those who are unfaithful to you. But as for me, the nearness of God is my good. I have made the Lord God my refuge, that I may tell of all your works. See, the final result is that when He comes back and He is clearly seeing, and He has this desire about who God is and how He desires nothing but Him and how He's going to receive Him in glory, and He recognizes that God is near, the only outcome is that we tell of His works. We can't be silent. Because we see people who are in the previous path, still looking at the old lens. We can't be silent. Not if we love them. Not if we care for them. We have to tell them that they can see things clearly, that there's something better. It's endless praise of the Lord. That's what it boils down to. Endless praise. All right, so I'm done. Anybody else got any closing questions, thoughts, comments as we wrap up? All right, Jeremiah, you want to close this out, please?